soul. What is he worth to you? What is he worth to you? What's he worth to soul? He died on the cruel tree for you and for me. What is he worth to your soul? All who will trust him in sunshine and gloom shall, when they reach the bright goal, ceasing to roam, be forever at home. What is he worth to your soul? What is he worth to you? What is he worth to you? What is he worth to your soul?
Love is a subject that is spoken of often, but it is often poorly understood. Some think of it as an emotion or feeling, but this same definition could also be given to hatred. Some think there are different kinds of love, such as a love for parent and a love for husband or wife, but no such distinction is made in the Bible. How does the Bible define love? In Romans 13, verse 10, love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. So we see that love is an intelligent act, the act of doing no harm to our neighbor, and our neighbor is anyone with whom we have to do. So anything which brings about harm to another is not love. Anything which causes another person to sin, such as fornication, is not love because it brings harm to that person in the form of sin. So the more we know about right and wrong, about God's will, the more we're able to practice this intelligent act of love. If we love not our brother, which means we'd be doing some kind of harm to our brother, we cannot love God. We invite you to join us in our study today.
Many days begin with sunshine, skies are clear and also blue. Then the dark clouds gather round us, hiding sun and sky from view. If we start to sing of glory, lift our voices in his praise. He has promised strength to lift us up, spirits of our heart to raise. All our dark clouds are shining when his glory brings us. When our day has come as father and the rain seems to be gentle, we just smile when he's singing. Then the Lord will say his praise. All our dark clouds and we soon have silver linings every day. Does your heart at times seem broken? From your eyes the tears do flow. Do the ones you count as true friends seem to vanish like the snow? Just remember there is someone up in heaven looking down. He will never leave, never will deceive, and for you he has a crown. All our dark love is never shining when he's gone with me to soul. When our day the sun is falling and the things we can go on, we just smile and start singing. Let the Lord receive his grace. All our dark clouds and the sun
As we continue in the 18th chapter of John, we're now ready to begin at the 12th verse. This portion of the chapter is telling about the arrest of Jesus by the Roman soldiers and the servants of the high priest. Peter had just cut off one of the ears of one of these servants of the high priest, whose name was Malchus, and Jesus had immediately healed it and told Peter to put his sword up into its sheath. And Jesus said in verse 11, "The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" Then in verse 12, "Then the band and the captain and officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him." Now, this word "then" really should be translated "therefore." As a result of the fact that Jesus had had Peter to put his sword up, there'd be no resistance. He was going to be arrested with no fight. Then they bound him. Let's notice who was involved here. The band and the captain and officers of the Jews. Here we have those that are Roman soldiers, members of the Roman army, and those that are servants of the priests and the Pharisees. Jews and Gentiles, two groups that are usually opposed to each other. They usually have nothing in common. The Gentiles, who come from a heathen background, who know not the true and living God, who have been taught to worship stick and stone if they worship anything at all. And then on the other hand, the Jews, who are the sons of the covenant. Yet they are able to unite on this one common ground, this one common goal of arresting the Son of God. Here we see an example of the amazing hardness of unconverted men. They were men who had marked differences among themselves, but yet they could unite in this evil deed. In one respect, they were all alike. They were blind to the glories of him whom they are now arresting. Both parties had just witnessed a very clear example of his power, when by a word from his lips he had thrown them all to the ground. Both parties had witnessed his tender mercy when they saw him heal the torn ear of this servant named Malchus. Yet they remained both insensible and unmoved, and now proceeded coolly to carry out the terrible business of arresting the Son of God. And certainly we can see that this is the state of the natural man. Let us not wonder then at the unbelief and hardness of heart which we see on every side today. These things continue to be among mankind today, just as they were shown in the presence of the Savior. This blindness of heart, this devotion of the natural man to destroy the things of God, will continue until he returns in judgment. So here we see that Jesus, after having entirely reconciled himself to the fact that he was going to die, he calmly surrendered and yielded himself a prisoner, not because he could not have made his escape, but because he would not. And one would have thought that the cure of Malchus's ear should have made them hold back, should have made them have second thoughts about what they were going to do. But nothing could change their purpose here. And so let's notice how they seized him. They took Jesus. Only a few of them could lay hands on him, but it's charged upon all of them, for they were all aiding and abetting in this act. In treason, there are no accessories. All are principles. And so now we see many scriptures are fulfilled. In Psalms 22:12, "Bulls have compassed me like bees," according to Psalms 18:12. Lamentations 4:20, "The breath of our nostrils is taken in their pit." In Psalms 105:17-18, "Joseph was sold for a servant, whose feet they hurt with fetters, he was laid in iron." And of course in Isaiah 53:5, "He was wounded for our transgressions, but bruised for our iniquities." Was it not when they bound his wrists and ankles with handcuffs and fetters that this prophecy also was fulfilled? They had so often been frustrated in their attempts to seize him that now, having got him into their hands, we may suppose that they flew upon him with so much the more violence. And let's notice how they secured him. They bound him. Only the writer John takes note of this binding of him like this. And so we see then that as soon as he was taken, as soon as he was arrested, he was bound. He was handcuffed. And we have to know that there was no kind treatment given here. There was no consideration for his feelings or for any pain that he might have had. He was treated like the worst criminal they could have ever have apprehended. And this shows the spite of his persecutors. They bound him that they might torment him and put him in pain as they bound Samson to afflict him, that they might disgrace him and put him to shame. Slaves were bound, and so Christ, though born free, was also bound. They bound him that they might prevent his escape. Judas having told them to hold him fast. So we see the true folly here when they thought that they could keep him from escaping if he really wanted to. They bound him as one already condemned, for they were resolved to prosecute him to the death. He was to die the death of the blackest criminal with his hands bound. Those who wanted to persecute Christ had had their consciences bound with the power of his word. They couldn't answer him back. They couldn't meet the arguments that he made, and this galled them. And so to get revenge on him, they laid these bonds on him. The fact that Christ was bound is very significant, and there's a lot of things about it that are really a mystery to us. We really don't understand all of the ramifications of this. Before they bound him, for example, he had bound himself by his own undertaking to the work and office of the mediator. He was already bound to the horns of the altar with the cords of his own love to man and duty to his Father, else their cords would not have held him. We were bound with the cords of our iniquities, Proverbs 5:22, with the yoke of our transgressions, Lamentations 1:14. Guilt is a bond on the soul by which we are bound over to the judgment of God. Corruption is a bond on the soul by which we are bound under the power of Satan. Christ, being made sin for us, to free us from those bonds, having submitted himself to be bound for us, else we had been bound hand and foot and reserved in chains of darkness. To his bonds we owe our liberty. His confinement was our freedom. Thus the Son maketh us free. We see also the types and prophecies of the Old Testament were brought about here. Isaac was bound that he might be sacrificed. Joseph was bound, and the irons entered into his soul in order to his being brought from prison to reign, in Psalms 115, verse 18. Samson was bound so that he could slay more Philistines at his death than he had done all of his life. And it was prophesied that the Messiah would be treated like a prisoner. In Isaiah 53, verse 8, he was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people was he stricken. We see a very deep significance in this binding of Christ. He was bound that he might bind us to duty and obedience. His bonds for us are bonds upon us, by which we are ever obliged to love him and serve him. And just as Paul said in Colossians 4:18, remember my bonds, we too should remember the bonds of Christ. We should remember his bonds as though we are bound with him from all sin, and bound to all duty. And then the captain and the officers took Jesus and bound him. 13 says, and laid Annas first, father-in-law to Caiaphas, was the high priest that year. We notice here that he led away to Annas. He wasn't driven, he wasn't dragged, he wasn't coerced into going, but he went willingly. He was led. And we see that the first Adam was actually driven from that garden, the Garden of Eden, whereas Jesus, the second Adam, was led from the Garden of Gethsemane. Also, we'd like to note that the lambs that were to be slaughtered were led to the high priest. And so here it was in the case of Christ. He was now being led to Annas. Now, let's notice some things about Annas. We don't know as much as we'd like to know about Annas, but he was a man who had been appointed as high priest in AD 4, and according to the law, of course, a high priest was to remain in that position all of his life. But the Roman political rulers here had interfered with this proper descendancy of the high priest, and so they were in the habit of appointing a high priest every year, which really went against the law. And so this year, Caiaphas, who was Annas' son-in-law, was the high priest. But as we stop and look at it, it may very well be that Caiaphas was recognized by the Roman authorities as the high priest for the political benefits. But yet, according to the law, Annas may still have been the truly recognized high priest among the Jews. As a matter of fact, Annas is still called high priest in the fourth chapter of Acts. But at any rate, Annas was a man of high prominence. And so whether he was actually high priest in the eyes of the Jewish authorities, or whether he was one who had been high priest and now was so closely connected with that office by kinship, it's hard to say. Actually, Annas had five sons who served as high priest, and here his son-in-law, Caiaphas, was high priest. So he was a very influential person. He no doubt had been one of the prime movers in this desire to arrest and condemn and slay Christ. he would of all people be most highly pleased at his arrest and capture now. And so they took him to Annas first. Here it was about midnight. Properly, he should have been simply just put into prison and maybe charged, or maybe he'd go before a justice of the peace until a proper hour for court, a proper hour for some kind of trial. Maybe give him time to build a case to defend himself, to have a lawyer and so forth, but not so in the case of Christ. He was treated as worse than the worst. He was taken in the middle of the night to his first accuser, to one of the judges, Annas. And he didn't stay at Annas' house very long. Annas hastily sent him on. In verse 24 we read, "Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest." But here was this old man who had been one of these stalwarts at this age in the Jewish religion. He was one that was no doubt muchly opposed to this man Christ. And so to please him and to set things off in the proper order, they first took him to Annas. Then Annas sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. We don't know what Annas did, what he said, what kind of examination he made, but he placed his stamp of approval on this whole arrest of Jesus and sent him on bound to Caiaphas. He was left in his bonds. We'd like to also note here that some of the Bible scholars note that Annas probably had to this very day go to the temple to approve of the sacrifices to be sure that they were without blemish. This was the day that the Passover had been observed. This was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so it's very appropriate then that symbolically and to fulfill all of the great plan of God, that here this sacrifice, Jesus Christ, the sacrifice for the world, this lamb will be brought before Annas, the high priest, to also be inspected to see if he was appropriately fitted to be offered as a sacrifice. And evidently Annas thought so, for he sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. And so here we see that Jesus fulfilled the prophecy and the type. In Leviticus 17:5, each animal that was to be offered in sacrifice was first led to the priest. So Christ was first brought to Annas. The road followed from the garden to the house of the high priest was also very significant. Gethsemane was at the foot of Mount Olivet, on the east side of Jerusalem, beyond the brook Cedron or Kidron. In journeying from there to the city, the gate through which they would pass was the Sheep Gate, referred to in Nehemiah 3, verse 1 and verse 32, and again in 12:39. And also John 5, verse 2 sheds some information on this. But the Sheep Gate was near to the temple, and through it the sacrificial animals passed, first having been fed in the meadows adjoining this brook Cedron. And so also went the true lamb on this occasion. Note the fact that he fulfills all of the type and all of the prophecies in regard to this. So it's most significant that he was led to the house of Annas first. And Annas probably didn't have very much political clout with the Roman establishment, and what he thought probably wasn't taken too much note of by them. But among these Jews, those who were adhering to the traditions that had been handed down among the Jewish people, they placed a lot of respect in the man Annas. And this old man, who was in some 64 years old at this time, no doubt carried a lot of weight with what he said and what he thought. He could have said, "No, this is an innocent man. We don't have any reason to hold him." But not so. He sent him on to Caiaphas. Caiaphas, his son-in-law, Caiaphas, the one who was recognized by the Roman government as having political authority, he was the high priest that same year. Verse 14 says, "Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people." Now this is referring back to what was said in John 11, verses 49 through 52. There the Jewish authorities were trying to decide what to do about Jesus, how they were going to be able to stop him, and they were afraid that if they didn't do anything, that he was going to make a threat to the Roman government and cause them a lot of trouble. That was one of the charges they made, although it wasn't a legitimate charge. But Caiaphas came up with an answer to that. In John 11, beginning with verse 49, "And one of them named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this spake he not of himself, but being high priest that same year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. And from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. Now the point is that Caiaphas was the very person who had decided, way back before Jesus was arrested, he had decided that he should die for the nation. He had already committed himself to that, act. He had already stated very emphatically that this man should die. And so we see then that this is the very man that Jesus had brought before to judge him. And so the judge has already stated, has already declared very emphatically that this man should die before there's any arrest, before there's any trial, before there are any witnesses, before there's any even in charge made. He's already decided he should die. So you can see what kind of justice would be meted out here. This is a very unjust situation. It was very inequitable. There's no way that Jesus stood any chance at all for having not only a fair trial, but it wasn't even a legitimate trial. He was already convicted and condemned before he got to his condemner. And so Caiaphas was the one that they took him to. And the injustice of the occasion was so apparent, was so much on the mind of John, that when he wrote about it, the first thing that came to his mind was that he was the one that said it was expedient that one man should die for the people. It took him to the very one who had been crying for his death. So he now goes from the house of Annas to the house of Caiaphas, the palace of the high priest. Remember, this is in the mid of night, sometime around midnight. The ordinary court processes are not functioning at this hour. But yet, this is of such an extreme importance to these Jews to put this man to death that they immediately spring the wheels into motion that'll be allowed to condemn him and to bring about a very rapid putting of him to death. We see that John tells some things here that the other Gospels do not relate. And as he tells the story of Peter's denial, instead of just telling his denial as one story by itself, he interweaves what Peter did with the other events of the night. So in verse 15, we have the first mention of Peter's denial. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door without. Then went out that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, and spake unto her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. So we see a very interesting thing. Peter followed along. We see that he's bound to have lost a great deal of his courage at this time, but yet he didn't lose all of his faith. He followed along. He wanted to see what happened. He didn't completely desert the master, but yet he followed at a distance. And so as Jesus was taken into this palace of the high priest, into the house of Caiaphas, Peter wasn't allowed to go in. He wasn't an acquaintance of the guard of the gate. And so he was one that would have to be left out. He could not be considered a member of the official party. But we see that there was another disciple that knew the high priest, and that was an acquaintance of the household of Caiaphas, and he was allowed to go in. We don't know who the other disciple was. There's been a lot of conjecture that maybe this was John, the writer of this book. However, we don't have any good reason to believe that John would be any more of an acquaintance of the high priest than any other apostles would be. But it could have been somebody like Nicodemus, who was on the council, or maybe Joseph of Arimathea. There could have been many other disciples that might have been an acquaintance of the high priest that could have served this function. And so they were recognized by the damsel that kept the gate, and they were allowed to go in, and this disciple was. And so when he saw that Peter couldn't come in, then he went out and spake to her that kept the door and brought in Peter. He seemingly did Peter a favor by allowing him to come into this palace of Caiaphas, where Christ was now being tried. He was now being examined. And actually, we see that he didn't really do Peter that much of a favor, because Peter didn't have enough faith. He didn't have enough true courage at this time to really stand for what he should have been standing for. And so we see in verse 17, "Then saith the damsel that kept the door unto Peter, Art not thou also one of this man's disciples? He saith, I am not." Here we see the challenge to him was given soon after he came in, or maybe at the time he came in the door. It was a rather mild challenge. It was only given by the damsel that kept the gate, not one of the guards, not one of the authorities, not someone who was a soldier of any rank, but by the damsel. And so had Peter been courageous, and that he had been going to act like a lion, he might have said, "Yes, I am, and what of it?" Or had he been wise as a serpent, he could nothing. But he quickly denied, "I am not," he said. His three denials. Right? But he has made the first one, and he shows very clear that he does not want to stand with Christ. He does not want to be counted among those that are his disciples. So verse 18 says, "And the servants and officers stood there who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold. And they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself." Here we see Peter numbering himself with those that are the enemies of Christ. He stands with them, and he pretends to be one of them. He pretends to be one of those that are only there because they want to see this man condemned. They want to see this man put to death. And so he numbers himself with the transgressors. Instead of being in that part of the building where the Savior is, instead of being there ready to bear witness for him, wanting to testify in his favor, wanting to do all that he can to see that the right thing is done, that this man is freed, no, he stands back and warms himself at the fire with the servants and the officers who were standing there to do the bidding of the high priest. Well, we'll have more about this story of Peter and the trial of Jesus in our next lesson. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
When he calls me home, never more to roam, I'll be ready then to go with him. Naught have I to fear with my Savior near, I'll be ready then to go with him. Night will fall, I will hear his call, then I'll say goodbye, O world of sin. I will take my place with the safe by grace, I'll be ready then to go with him. When my work is done at the setting sun, I'll be ready then to go with him. To that home on high, way up in the sky, I'll be ready then to go with him. Shades of light will fall, I will hear his call.
Also do it, do with it, whatever he wants to.